BFFT. From the PAC West Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with the bald-faced truth.
Tony Petitti, the commissioner of the Big Ten Conference, may be our last hope for someone in college football in a position of authority and power to pump the brakes and think about the ecosystem, the greater good of college athletics. You might remember when I did my one-on-one with Petitti in July, I asked him, is there a responsibility that the SEC and the Big Ten, and is there a responsibility that those entities have as it pertains to the greater good? Do they owe a debt of obligation to the ecosystem? Heard a lot of talk in the last few days about the Big Ten and the SEC putting their heads together. Greg Sankey, the SEC commissioner, saying, hey, it's not our job to dumb it down. It's not our job to bring it back down to earth. It's their job, meaning the other power conferences, to rise up. Probably not acknowledging that there are some advantages that the SEC has leveraged. It's made some nice chess moves. Happens to have schools in a footprint that is football crazy. The viewership in the SEC, the size of the stadiums in the SEC, all inherent advantages for Greg Sankey's conferences. I'm not saying if he's right or wrong, but I want you to help me solve it in this segment of radio. I think we can solve it in about 10 minutes. Remember when I asked Tony Petitti about the health of college football, the overall health, and he went into a long diatribe about, you know, I would argue that college football is doing better than ever. But I really was getting at whether the Big Ten Conference had a debt of or an obligation to maybe think about the ecosystem. Here's what Tony Petitti told me in our one-on-one.
The metrics, if we're going to measure the health of college football, people will turn to TV numbers. But people on the West Coast will often say, we don't feel like we're part of, we weren't part of the playoff for many years. I think 9 of the 11 years, they, you know, there was no representation. Kind of felt like it was happening somewhere else. In your mind, what, how should we measure the health of the of this sport?
I think it's a combination of a lot of different metrics. I think it's everything from, you know, the engagement across, you know, look, obviously ratings and media engage on social and all that engagement and interaction. It's the fact that, look, you know, to, not to get too personal with you, but you've built something that's built on the passion of people who love college sports, mainly football, right? And you can see the engagement you can generate off of that passion. So I think that's part of it. What's happening in the stadiums, you know, in terms of the attendance and the growth and the interest. And I think when I think about, you know, the overall health of all of it, what I would say is college football is great, but it actually can continue to get better. Like, there's more that we can do, right, to make it even better, get the postseason format right, figure out the right scheduling. There's a lot of opportunities, and it's a really rare thing when you have something that's so good and there's still opportunities to make it better. And that's a great place to be. So I feel like it's really healthy. I think at the same time, as content gets delivered and changes, you know, sports is what's holding a lot of the current system together because it's live. And so you're seeing bigger and bigger investments being made in that. So I feel really good about that.
Tony Petitti and Greg Sankey are going to talk next week. And one of the things they're going to talk about is how many playoff berths their respective conferences should be jockeying for. They now have essentially one automatic qualifier because the champion in the SEC and the champion in the Big Ten are going to be among the top five highest ranked conference champions in just about every year that you could imagine. And so they will get one automatic berth for their conference champion, but they've talked about wanting three or four in a 14 team playoff. Could you imagine an expansion to 14 teams and three or four automatic qualifiers? ESPN's Heather Dinich had a commentary about this today, and she quoted an unnamed source in the SEC who said, look, even if we get four, That's 25% of our league. There's not another sport we compete in where less than half our league is getting into the postseason. In the NFL, that this person argued, 38% of the teams get into the postseason. We've got to figure out a way, or just dumb down our schedule and try to get in that way. But that's not what anybody wants, end quote. Another source said, there's no perfect way to do this. Once upon a time, we used computers to make the selections, the BCS, remember that? People weren't happy with it. Someone got left out. But if someone gets left out of the playoff, doesn't that make the making the playoff great? Part, I think, of the beauty of even Major League Baseball's playoff or even the NFL playoff, where 38% of the teams get into the postseason, is that getting to the postseason means something. Making the playoffs means something. It should mean something. How many teams, how many spots, how many automatic qualifiers? I want you to argue for or against your conference, the conference you love. I want you to argue for or against college athletics. If you're somebody who loves college football, what's the right number of automatic berths for the Big Ten or the SEC? You know, if it's a 14-team playoff, does anybody really need more than their conference champion as a automatic qualifier? What is the SEC and the Big Ten really after here? They want to guarantee their spots. They want to guarantee their revenue. They want to guarantee a minimum number of teams in the playoff. And certainly, you could argue that in the four-team playoff history and the BCS history, that the SEC and the Big Ten fared very well. So you tell me, how many automatic spots do you need? What does it need to look like? And what's best for the sport? I'm going to ask you that. If you propose something, I'm going to say, all right, what's best for the sport? 503-417-7575 is the phone number, as always. We have a great show today. John Wilner of the San Jose Mercury News will be joining us this hour to kind of talk about college football. We both made picks against the spread this week. I want to get Wilner's mind on what is the most interesting games of the week are, what he makes of Teresa Gold, the Pac-12 commissioner, landing Gonzaga in the Pac-12. We'll talk to Wilner about that in the 3 o'clock hour. In the 4 o'clock hour, it'll be Jim Etzel of Sport Oregon. He's the CEO of Sport Oregon. Think about what's happened in sports. I said it on yesterday's show. WNBA to Portland. Major League Baseball gets a parcel of land. NCAA announces that the women's regional is coming back to Portland in 2028. And then the Final Four coming in 2030. That 2028 regional will be a lot like a dress rehearsal for the Final Four. Jim Etzel will be joining us. We'll talk to him about what comes next. How viable is baseball? He'll take a victory lap, of course, on some of the stuff that has gone on. But, you know, I want to ask Etzel what's coming next. Can they seize the momentum that Portland seemingly has right now with some uptick in sports enthusiasm and some things that have broke the way of Portland? A long time, it feels like a long time that the Portland market, you know, wasn't benefiting, and people were going, ooh, nobody wants to come here. NCAA doesn't want to bring an event there. And all of a sudden now, WNBA is coming. Major League Baseball eyeing Portland, of course. Yesterday's show, I ticked some people off. I rankled some people. I wouldn't say I ticked them off. I rankled some people by leaking some photos that were from inside the architectural firm Populous. The people at Populous were like, how did those get out? Sorry. And by the way, in one of those renderings, it kind of looks like the stadium like might float a little bit. Is it possible we could have a stadium that they could pivot depending on what time the game, you know, has first pitch? I'm just spitballing here. Like, how creative could they get with the stadium? I don't know. Jim Etzel joining us in the 4 o'clock hour. It's Thursday Night Football tonight, so we'll have an early out. Jaden Robinson, who normally joins us, you want to say student athletes and laugh about it? Well, Jaden Robinson normally joins us for the Jamba interview in the 4 o'clock hour. He has class from 3 to 5 today. So we're gonna have Jaden on tomorrow's show, and he'll be on tomorrow. So he's got class, student athlete, telling you. So Jaden Robinson will be joining us tomorrow, not today, in his Jamba interview. Stephen Vaughn, how many automatic berths does the SEC and the Big Ten need? Because they're huddling together trying to figure out how much of this pie they should take for themselves.
Well, how much do they need? I think it would be They probably need both of their conference champions in, right? And then I think whoever they played against. So two each in their conference. I think that's what I would be willing to give up. Like, okay, if you make it to the conference championship game, as long as there's no divisions, you keep the no divisions thing in the Big Ten, the SEC, and you have the top two teams in those conferences, I'd be okay with guaranteeing those spots. But what would be the best for college football in the sport? It would just be the conference champions, and that's it. And have every other team earn their way in. However they're going to vote teams into that college football playoff, they have to get in that way. But I think for me, like, I would be okay with saying, yeah, you can have two teams in there in the college football playoff 14-team field, as long as they're the two teams that played in that conference championship game. The winner and the loser are both in it.
I think for me, the health of the ecosystem and what they want are not congruent thoughts. They being the Big Ten and the SEC. Greg Sankey, who I'd known for a long time and I respect, I mean, he's a guy who came up in college athletics. He's worked at a variety of places. He's a smart guy. He happens to have the best cards at the table for this poker game. And so the SEC is playing those cards. I wish, like in a Pollyanna world, that the SEC and the Big Ten looked at the system and went, hey, look, yeah, we could take it all for ourselves. We could each have four automatic qualifiers. We could guarantee ourselves four spots in the playoff every year. But, you know, what's probably right is that, you know, the major conferences all get a conference champion in. There's one for the group of five. And then all the rest should be at-large berths. You want to expand the playoff, expand the playoff. More SEC and Big Ten teams are going to get those at-large berths just because, you know, historically you look at the rankings and that's what would happen, as long as they continue to win on the levels that they won at before. But I think it's really important in this year's playoff that there's representation from other conferences. And I even think it's important if there's representation, even if those teams aren't winning at the highest level. When you look at Major League Baseball's playoffs this year, it's fantastic that you've got some teams that feel like it's fresh and new. They're here for the first time. You've got some teams that, oh, it's perennial powers. These are the two best teams. Maybe we'll see them in the end. Maybe we won't. But there is something to having these other teams that aren't the favorites participate in Major League Baseball's playoffs. There's something to the eighth seed in the Western Conference getting a taste of the playoffs, understanding what it is to get to the postseason. They can utilize that to build, find out where their deficiencies are, get some playoff experience. There's value in just getting to the playoffs for some of these other teams. You know, it shouldn't have always just been in college football that we have either the two best teams picked by a computer or the two best teams picked by a panel or the four best teams picked in a very small expansion of the playoff. Or now what we're going to see this year, and nobody quite knows what to expect, 12 teams with five automatic qualifiers for the five highest-ranked conference champions. So whatever the case is, I think it's important that there's representation, even if they get their brains beat in. Because I can tell you that in talking to NBA players or even NFL players who got to the playoffs for the first time as a young player with maybe a franchise that's kind of trying to rebuild and striving to get to a Super Bowl one day, I don't think there's any illusion sometimes in the wild card round of the NFL that some of the teams are just playing in the playoffs and are probably not going to get to the Super Bowl. You can circle a couple of those teams every year that are just kind of there. First time, they haven't been in the playoffs in a while. They've got some players who haven't had a lot of playoff experience, and it's part of their progression if they can put the other pieces in place. I think it's important for the Big 12 to have a representative in the playoff. I think it's important for the ACC to have representatives. I think it's important for the group of five to get some representation in the playoff. My fear is that if the SEC and the Big 10, you know, if they really believe in their strength and really believe, you know, have confidence that their teams are going to get there as the rankings unfold, and you say, okay, if it's a 14-team playoff, you got a group of five champion, that probably means you got 13 teams coming from the Power Four. And, you know, those at-large berths, by and large, should go to the SEC and should go to the Big Ten. And maybe the ACC and the Big 12 in a given year could get three or four teams in if they had just a sensational year. But if you lock it down and you essentially say, you know, if the NFL said, hey, look, we think the NFC is the better conference, and so, you know, instead of having balanced playoffs, we're only going to allow four teams from the AFC to get into the playoff. That's not a system that we think we would all agree that it's not a system that's great for the NFL. regardless. And, you know, people who talk about reseeding the teams and the leagues will always push back against reseeding. I'm not talking about reseeding. I'm talking about guaranteeing an outcome here. You know, you're talking about guaranteeing that the SEC and the Big Ten are going to, you know, have these eight teams out of the 14. And it's just, it's not great for the great, you know, the system and the greater good. But how many do they need? Do they deserve more than one? I mean, 503-417-7575, you tell me what the stakes are. And, you know, I know Greg Sankey. I sat down with Tony Petitti. I'm planning to sit down with him next week. He's coming to the Ohio State-Oregon game. He says he's flying in early. He says, can we grab coffee? And when I'm on my drive, I'm going to sit down with Petitti. I'm going to ask him, like, just frankly, like, hey, you know, what you and Greg Sankey, you're trying to run away with this thing. And Sankey's comments yesterday, he made these comments on a podcast where, you know, he kind of talked about, you know, his vision, you know, basically, you know, don't ask us to come back to the pack. Don't ask us, you know, it's essentially, you know, the comparison of when UConn women's basketball was beating everybody and people were saying, these aren't even games. What's the point? You know, like, he kind of made that comparison. He didn't cite UConn. He just said, it's not our job to come back to earth, you know, and I rolled my eyes at it because I don't necessarily see the SEC's champion every year on another planet. Like, they play football on Earth, and they play football that's on a level that in recent years has been a fair comparison with Clemson or Oklahoma in a given year or Ohio State or Michigan last year. It's not like the SEC champion is running away with it. So I'm left in a position saying, wouldn't it be more valuable to the SEC to just say, hey, it's an automatic berth for your conference champion, but gosh, if you get four teams in, what a statement that makes about your league. But go earn it on the field. But don't have it be subsidized.
But isn't the problem where the SEC and the Big Ten, they hold so much power, so they're not going to agree to that. And so, like you said, they want to get as many guaranteed spots as they can. So that's why what I was saying is you compromise and you try to just say, hey, if you get to their conference championship game, both of those schools get in for sure. Like, that's the best compromise to me, because I feel like if you hold them to, if you try to play hardball with them and you say, no, you have to win the conference championship and that's it, that's when they're going to hold their power. They're going to try to make a power move and say, no, like, we're out of here.
So yeah, part of the problem, though, Stephen, part of the problem is, you know, there's obviously an executive committee that is in charge of the playoff, but as part of the negotiations last time around, the rest of the conferences ceded some power to the Big Ten and the SEC, and are allowing them to kind of make some decisions. And I know I talked with Kirk Schultz, the Washington State president, around the time it was all going down. He was very concerned that the SEC and the Big Ten were going to try to run away with it. And I think, you know, you're seeing some of that right now. And as smart as I think Greg Sankey is, I'm left going, gosh, does anybody care about the greater good? Does anybody care about the game itself? Is anybody looking out for college athletics, or are they really just going to let the SEC and the Big Ten run away with it? I am very concerned about it. We got a great show for you today. We're going to talk a little bit about the Major League Baseball playoffs. We will touch on the NFL, big Thursday night game coming up. Stephen and I are going to give our leans for the games coming up this weekend. Which way are we leaning? What are we picking? I have a couple games I feel really good about. I wonder if Steven will agree with me. If he does, I'm going to be worried about my pick. John Wilner coming up next, though. We'll talk about the weekend in college football, what he makes of Gonzaga to the Pac-12, and what's the next move for the Pac-12. Plus, Jonathan Smith's triumphant return to Autzen Stadium. I've said a lot of words and written a lot of words about Jonathan Smith coming back. I want to hear from listeners about how they feel about the coach at Michigan State coming back to the state of Oregon. I had a reader this morning at johnconzano.com because I filed my picks for the week, and a reader immediately shot me a note and said, hey, if he drops his Michigan State gear at Goodwill, is that a bad sign? Too soon for that? I don't know. We'll talk about Jonathan Smith later in the show. Wilner's next. Leave it here.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
We've been talking about the SEC and the Big Ten. Are they going to ruin it? Are they greedy? Do they want it all for themselves? How many automatic bids do they need? We've got some people lined up who want to weigh in. John Wilner is our guest, San Jose Mercury News, Bay Area News Group. He is the star of Canzano and Wilner, the podcast. We're going to have him on. Actually going to bring on some callers while I have him on. We'll do it a little different because that's how this show rolls. How are you, my friend?
I appreciate that introduction that could not have been further from the truth, but I'm good, thanks.
Hey, before we're going to take a couple calls because we've been talking about the SEC and the Big Ten. What are they trying to do? What's your simple answer? What are Greg Sankey and Tony Petitti up to?
They want 16 automatic bids for a 14-team playoff is what they want.
Right.
I mean, that's every breadcrumb they throw out in front of us says, you know, we don't care about competitive equity. We want to own every spot possible in the playoff. And we'll see. I think they'll probably end up getting their way or most of their way because they do have all the best brands, and ESPN is going to want, you know, ESPN wants the best brands on TV. So it works in their favor.
Is there any chance that they come to their senses and go, look, this isn't great for the ecosystem? Or will they just go, nope, we're taking it all for ourselves? I mean, is there any shot that they have a conscience as they move towards that model?
No, I don't think so, at least not voluntarily. The way they get a conscience is if they're threatened with lawsuits because of some kind of exclusionary policy. I mean, you know, one of the potential outcomes of all this is that the Group of Five does not have an automatic bid. And so then you would have basically 5 out of 9 conferences with no guaranteed access to the playoff. And that could result in a lawsuit or the threat of a lawsuit. That is really, to me, the best bet to keeping them in line is the threat of legal action.
Well, maybe we need that. I want to take a couple calls because before I get into, like, you know, what you think's happening this weekend, Jonathan Smith's return, but maybe you get to participate a little bit with some listener interaction. Let's go to Jonathan, who's in Portland. Jonathan, you are on the platform. What's on your mind, man?
Thanks, long-time listener. Love your show. You know, my view on this is it's not about Big Ten versus SEC. It's about Fox and ESPN. And I think, you know, what you said about legal action is pretty much 100% correct, because right now we've just allowed ESPN and Fox to engage in what I don't want to say anything legalese exactly, but it doesn't feel right. It feels like they went and butchered the existing conference layout in exactly the time when we actually had conference championships that meant something, because you had a division, you had to win your side of the conference, and then you went to the conference championship, and if those
sure.
people all went, the whole season kind of feels like a playoff. And now you've got the SEC and the Big Ten where not everybody plays each other, and it's going to be this weird, mysterious algorithm as to which of the top three teams in the championship.
Yeah, you're breaking up. But, Wilner, let me dovetail off of that. You know, what if the SEC and the Big Ten go, we're just not going to play anybody else? We'll play our regular season, and then we'll do cross-conference matchups with the Big Ten. Does that lock other teams out of the playoff, or how does that affect college football?
Well, that's the threat. And certainly the caller is right that ESPN and Fox, they're kind of like the grand masters behind college football here. ESPN all in with the SEC, Fox all in with the Big Ten. So they could try to lock everybody out and, you know, just take their ball and go play their own game. That's the threat that they've used to kind of get their own way. I am a little skeptical of that because I think politically that would be tough. Let's say in a state like Kentucky, where you've got a school, Louisville, that's in the ACC and a school, Kentucky, in the SEC, you know, and all of a sudden Kentucky is going to go off and play a different game, you know, then state politicians start getting involved. So that's why I'm a little skeptical that ultimately they would break away, but they are certainly using that threat to their advantage.
I want to take one more, and then I got questions for you. Ken's in Portland. Ken, go ahead. What's on your mind?
What I wanted to say is from Roy Kramer to Mike Slive to Greg Sankey, The SEC has leveraged all their advantages to be the top conference. But I think that Sankey is smart enough to realize that with NIL replacing the SEC Bagman, with the expansion of the playoff, and with the push to move from an 8-game schedule, which benefits the SEC in their rankings unfairly, to a 9-game schedule, they have never been more powerful, and they never will be more powerful than what they are now. And so he's leaning on the system to get what he can get now, because I think we're going to see over time there's going to be a dilution. There's not going to be those super teams. It's not going to be as easy as it used to be for an Alabama to rise up and dominate college football like it did, you know. And so I think that that's what what's happening here. He's leveraging. He's a smart guy. He's leveraging his opportunity to get what he can get now.
Yeah, give me an idea, Wilner. What do you see there? Do you think the SEC and the Big Ten fear that there'll be more parity?
No, I don't know that I necessarily agree with that piece of it. They've got all the best schools, basically, except for Notre Dame. The reason, but they do want to keep their hold on power. There's no doubt about that, which is why college football does not have a commissioner or a czar. And if there was a commissioner that had some real authority, a lot of the idiocy and insanity that we see would not exist. But by the very act of creating a commissioner, the SEC and the Big Ten would give up their hegemony, their authority over the whole sport, and they don't want to do that. Right now, Sankey and Petitti are running the whole thing. So why would they allow a commissioner to take over? They wouldn't. So it's going to continue to be, in a way, a lawless, leaderless sport industry.
I'm fascinated by what happens next. Do you have a sense of what kind of authority Sankey and Petitti, those two conference commissioners, have to make changes to the playoff? Do they need the executive council, the management committee of the CFP to sign off, or did they negotiate some extra power and leverage in that last round of negotiations?
Well, my understanding is it's pretty much up to them and ESPN, right? So the current CFP, and the timelines are a little difficult to follow. The CFP that we're getting at this season is for 12 teams is also on the books for next season. But after next season, so starting with the fall of 26, it's a new contract. They have signed that contract with ESPN. They know how much money is involved. They know how much money is going to get distributed to each conference. But they could still, you know, the format itself is something that's got to be figured out. They could decide to go to 14 teams or 16. They could decide to give the SEC and the Big Ten, you know, automatic spots. All that's got to be worked out, but that starts with the 2026 season, and the power to make any changes is basically just with ESPN, the SEC, and the Big Ten, and everybody else has got to take what they're given.
John Wilner with us, San Jose Mercury News. Pivoting to the weekend of action in college football, you're headed to the state of Oregon, Friday night game, Michigan State, Oregon, and I believe you're then getting in the car and driving to Washington, Michigan. You're going to get to see games, four teams. What prompts you to see those games? What's the appeal?
The main appeal is I get two for the price of one, because I get Oregon on Friday night and Washington on Saturday afternoon. I was a little worried the Huskies were going to get the 12:30 spot. That would have been an early drive for me on Saturday out in the Portland area. But they're 4:30 on NBC, so it works out really well. That's the main reason I'm doing it. I get to see Oregon, Washington, at both Michigan schools, including Jonathan Smith. It's, you know, it's like the old days of the Pac-12 with Smith and Autzen.
I think Smith coming to Autzen. How mad should Oregon State fans be at him, or what's the outside view of that? Because I might be too close to this, with a lot of listeners angry at him for dropping his stuff at Goodwill, others saying, gosh, if there's no loyalty to your alma mater, where is their loyalty? Others yet going, hey, it's show business, not show friends. What's the view from 20,000 feet on Jonathan?
I think the view is that if the Pac-12 hadn't disintegrated, he wouldn't have taken the job. But he was worried about what was going to happen, and you know, just for his own coaching career and getting stuck in a situation where he would never have, you know, because of what was going on with the Pac-12, he would not have the resources to win at the level he wanted to win at, and eventually to maybe move up. You know, I don't know that he was ever going to be a lifer at Oregon State. You could certainly argue he took the program as far as he could take it and did a lot of great things for Oregon State, and it was time to move on. Now, I'd also say I think he made a mistake, because I think Michigan State was a long job for him. He is going to get caught in the grind of the Big Ten at a mid-level program right there, like middle of the hierarchy there. And it's going to be hard for him to ever do anything extraordinary or exceptional at Michigan State, in my opinion.
Wilner, you know, when you say extraordinary or exceptional, where do you see Michigan State's ceiling in that conference as it stands?
I mean, every once in a while, maybe they end up in the top two or three, but you just start counting. It's going to be hard on any given year. Are they going to be better than Ohio State, Penn State, Michigan, USC, Washington, Oregon? I mean, you could argue they are at best seventh in the pecking order, just in terms of resources, recruiting prowess, all that kind of thing. He's a really good coach. There's no doubt about that. A really good coach. But I just don't know that he's going to be able to get the players he needs to compete with the schools that are in that conference. It's brutal.
Oregon and Dan Lanning, they would like very much to matter in the college football playoff. Not just make it, I think, but rattle around it. And, you know, in the back of their mind, they're thinking national championship. They want to get Phil Knight that title. How far away do you think Oregon is? You've seen Georgia and Alabama play. We're going to get to see Oregon and Ohio State in a couple of Saturdays. But where do you see the Ducks?
I don't know that Oregon could ever get there, to be honest. I just don't know that it's possible. And I also am not sure that it's Oregon's fault. So much of college football is dependent upon demographics. And where are all the really good 300-pound offensive and defensive linemen? They're in the South and in the Midwest. So the whole personnel pipeline skews. I mean, that is one of the main reasons the SEC has had the dominant run that it's had, is that's where all the linemen are. And you can't win a playoff without a bunch of NFL draft picks on your lines of scrimmage. Now, Oregon does, I think, a really good job of getting as close to that point as they can, but until I see them line up in a semifinal or final against Ohio State, Alabama, Georgia, those schools, LSU, when they're rolling, I just don't know that they're going to ever have it up front. And I think that that's true of Washington. USC is a little different. I do think USC has some advantages with their tradition, that if they got the right coach, they could potentially win it, but it's hard. And it didn't used to be. You know, this is a shift in population dynamics that's taken place. West Coast doesn't have as many big, fast players as it used to.
Yeah, you look at Oregon in 2011, Oregon in 2015, and Washington in 2024, the three playoff national championship game participants from the Pacific Northwest were collectively outrushed 853-253 in those three title games. And
yeah,
it was the difference. And as Chip Kelly said, big people beat up little people.
Yeah, they do. And I don't know, you know, Oregon does a great job getting kids out of the South and the Midwest, but are they going to get enough kids in a given year who can play at that level? It's going to be hard. Real hard. But the playoff gives them certainly a better chance to be relevant. The Ducks should be in the playoff this year. If they're not, I think it's a disappointment. And they probably, Washington and Oregon both, should probably be in the playoff every two or three years, with the Big Ten getting, you know, you assume they're going to get about four teams. The Pacific Northwest schools should be in it, you know, on a pretty regular basis. And whether they can get through the quarterfinals, you know, win an opening round game for sure. Get through the quarterfinals, that'll be tough. And then it just, I just don't see him ever winning those last two.
You had a piece on Teresa Gold, the Pac-12 commissioner today, and the role she played in landing Gonzaga. Big week for the Pac-12. Can you share with us a little bit of her role and how important she was to that?
Well, it sounds to me like, and I didn't realize this as things were breaking, what was that, Monday, Tuesday, she was the real linchpin on the whole thing. She flew to Spokane last weekend on her own without her consulting firm, Navigate, and basically spent 10 hours in Spokane on Sunday with Gonzaga's president, athletic director, and the basketball coaches hammering out a deal. And it was an ultimate example of what personal relationships mean in college sports and how you can get stuff done in person that you can't get stuff done remotely. And she's known Gonzaga's athletic director for decades. I think that that really helped with the trust factor in the negotiations. And she got it done. And it's a huge... I mean, getting Gonzaga is a gigantic deal for the Pac-12, right? I mean, that is a massive brand that everybody across the country is like, oh, Gonzaga's in the Pac-12. It's that big a deal.
Now, as they look for that eighth school that plays all sports, or maybe a ninth, they're going to go to market with their media rights. I'm sure they're going to get, you know, the media companies to model deals that include a variety of schools. What is that range in your mind? You know, obviously I think about Memphis and Tulane and UNLV, but how far outside that scope do you think they'll go in potentially modeling deals?
I think they'll be as creative as they could possibly be, as creative as their network or media partners will let them be. I think the fact that they can go down the streaming path will add to their optionality. I'm also not sure that any school that's out there, whether it's Memphis on down, is going to make a real difference in their valuation. I mean, I basically think that it is set with the seven they have, plus, you know, the seven football schools plus Gonzaga. I think whatever that media valuation is will not change regardless of who that eighth or ninth school is. It's going to just, you know, they'll build in some escalator clauses so everybody will basically stay the, you know, not lose money by getting the extra schools. But I don't see anybody that's going to all of a sudden turn this into a bonanza that it isn't.
UNLV, that memo of understanding, binding, or is there some wiggle room for UNLV here?
I am not sure, but I don't think that UNLV's got any wiggle room. I think that they've signed a grant of rights. Not 100% sure. It's the way it sounds to me. But it could be with both the Mountain West and the American Conference that there's a time factor. Like the grant of rights starts on X date. And so, you know, maybe in 2 or 3 weeks, those schools could still leave. I don't really know. It's a little bit murky. I'm also not 100% sure the Pac-12 would want UNLV at this point. Certainly they're not going to pay $25 million to get them, right? And that's what the Mountain West did. The Pac-12 was, I think they were smart not paying that because UNLV is not worth that much money. Again, there's nobody out there that's going to materially change the media value of the group that they have. Why not get Sacramento State? They'll come for free. You give them like $10 a year and everybody else gets an extra share. I mean, there's just more money for everybody else.
Look at you. You're thinking like Greg Sankey now. Look at that. Make them don't come back to Earth. Make them find you on the moon. All right,
there
John Wilner, I appreciate you, man. I'm looking forward to seeing you tomorrow as you head out to up to or down to Autzen Stadium, and I'll catch you then. Thanks, Wilner.
Thanks, my friend. I'll see you.
There he goes. He's coming to the Pacific Northwest. He's on a tour. He's going to be at Michigan State, Oregon tomorrow night. He'll be at Michigan, Washington on Saturday night. Stephen Vaughn and I will give our picks on the Pacific Northwest games in the next segment. Stephen, I wrestled with Washington, Michigan. I want to see if we ended up in the same place. Leave it here. Our Big Splash is next as well.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
All right, Steven, I had a full list of my week six picks, thoughts, predictions online at johnconzano.com. I am still at about 58% for the season against the spread. I was very mediocre last week, 4-6 against the spread. That is really bad. It was a weird straight-up week, too. There were some strange games that ended up being won by underdogs, like Colorado beating going on the road, beating Central Florida as an underdog on the road. We had some weird things going on like that. This week, I want to focus right now, here and now, on the Pacific Northwest games. We'll start with the Friday game. Michigan State, 3-2 at Oregon, 4-0, 6 o'clock tomorrow on Fox. Spread is Oregon favored by 23.5. How do you see that game?
You know, I have Oregon winning the game, but I have Michigan State staying within that number. I think it's going to be like 31-14, 34-14, something like that.
Oh, jeez, we have the same score.
No, I'm sorry. I'm joking.
No. But Michigan State's winning now.
Straight up, they are.
Do the opposite, Jerry.
I feel like this is just such a look-ahead spot for the Ducks, right? Like, they're looking forward to Ohio State next week. And Michigan State, John, last week, 3 turnovers all inside the red zone in the first half against Ohio State. Their offense is not as bad as... They're not as bad as people make it out to be. So I think I just think they can stay within the number.
I think Ohio State's a little better than Oregon. So I am looking ahead. And I looked at that same thing, how Michigan State played Ohio State, and I came away with the same damn score, 31-14 Oregon. So Oregon wins very easily, but does not cover the 23.5 in my book. Man.
It's a bad start.
It's a bad omen.
Sorry, Duck
for
fans.
Me. Yeah. Colorado State, 2-2 at Oregon State, 3:30 Saturday on the CW. Oregon State's an 11-point favorite at Reser Stadium against Colorado State. I'll go first on this one. Beavers off a bye week. Trent Bray yesterday on the show talked about King of Queens, talked about the Cobra Kai show. I think Oregon State's defense is the dominant unit in this game. I think it gives Colorado State fits. I saw how Colorado played Colorado State. The Colorado defense that I'm not that impressed with gave Colorado State fits. And so I have Colorado State only scoring 10 points in this game. And so in order to cover the 11, all the Beavers have to do is get to 21. I think they do. I think it's 24-10 Oregon State.
I agree with you. Not the exact score, but I same blind to thinking here. We saw what Oregon State did to Purdue, who's going to be a much more physical team than Colorado State. And so I think Oregon State can kind of impose their will on the Rams this week down in Corvallis. And going into the season, like, I would have definitely taken Colorado State plus double-digit points.
Sure.
But after watching how both of these teams have played, you got to give Oregon State a lot of credit for how they've done this season. Trent Bray, you know, first-year head coach of the Beavs, he's got it going on. So I'm with you. I like the Beavs, and I would lay the points in that one.
Here is a game I thought was the hardest of the three in the Northwest. Michigan 4-1 at Washington 3-2. 4:30 Saturday on NBC and Peacock. Bounce back for the Huskies. They were terrible. Self-inflicted wounds against Rutgers. Guys running on the field, getting penalties when they should be on the sideline. And Michigan's lost 4 of 5 the last games they played on the West Coast. So I think Washington fans can get a little hope here, but I just don't trust Washington. And I don't like picking teams that I don't trust. So even though Washington's favored in this game by 2.5, that surprised me a little bit. I think Michigan wins ugly. 21-18, Michigan.
We are on opposite sides of this one, John. I think Washington wins. I think they win by a touchdown. Alex Orji, the starting quarterback for Michigan, he's 17 for 30. Not just in his last game, in his last two games for 118 yards in two games passing. He can't throw the football. Michigan has no passing attack. And this is Michigan's first road game. The fans are going to be excited up in Seattle. It's going to be loud. I think the combination of that, I think Washington also, like you said, they shot themselves in the foot against Rutgers. They probably should have won that game. I think Washington bounces back. They get to 4-2 and they beat Michigan.
Don't you think Michigan has the best win, though, between the two teams? They beat USC.
They definitely do.
They have the best win. And so I'm leaning on that a little bit. I thought this game would be Michigan as a slight favorite. And So when I saw 2.5, I was like, okay.
This screams to be like a 20-14 like slugfest. And so, yeah, I'm with you. I don't think it's going to be an exciting game by any means, but I do think Washington, home field advantage, I think that has a little bit to play with it. And so I think just it's a non-passing game for Michigan. So I think that's really going to hurt them on the road.
I have it 21-18. What was your score?
I got 20-14 Washington.
Yeah, see. Hide that one on Peacock. All right. Coming up in the 4 o'clock hour, Jim Etzel will be joining us around 4:20. He'll be talking about the NCAA regional that Portland just landed. He'll be talking about the WNBA to Portland, what can be done on the MLB to PDX front, the Blazers getting a TV deal. There's all kinds of momentum. Sport Oregon, is that you? Are they doing this? Are they greasing the wheels on this stuff? I'll ask Etzel about that and more coming up at 4:20. We're going to play Punch It Audio next. For those of you waiting for Jaden Robinson, the Oregon State captain, he's going to appear on tomorrow's show. He's got class. He's a student-athlete, people. What do you want? You want me responsible and in the way of his education? No, thank you. So Jaden Robinson tomorrow on the show. Leave it here.
BFFT. From the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with the bald-faced truth.
I thought yesterday's first hour of the show flew by. Today's first hour might have been faster, Stephen. I don't know what that's about. You know, if you ever worked retail, if you ever worked a job like at a restaurant, the day does go faster if you're busy, doesn't it? Have you ever worked a retail job?
Yes, I have. I've worked at Fred Meyer, and I've also worked at Costco as well.
What's the difference? Spill the tea on those two places.
Well, I was the shoe guy at Fred Meyer, so I wasn't like I wasn't like bagging groceries or anything. Where at Costco, I was doing the groceries. And then I was also doing the stock boy in the morning. So it was a little different of jobs. But to your point, yeah, at Costco, those lines get so big. And when it's super big like that, you just don't even recognize it. And you just keep going and the time flies. See a lot of weird people, though.
I've had a lot of bad jobs. I shouldn't say bad. I've had a lot of jobs that taught me things. My first job ever, really, where I was paid, I worked at a Christmas tree farm. I made $5 an hour. It was hard work. And I'm not talking about working at the Christmas tree farm only during like 2 weeks in the run-up to Christmas, or a month in the run-up to Christmas where everybody's getting their tree and it's like, you know, oh, it's such a cool place to work. I'm talking about moving irrigation pipes in the middle of summer and trimming trees in October. And sap on your clothes and your hands, and three nuns pulling up in a Winnebago and saying, hey, we want that tree at the far corner of the lot, but we don't want to walk out there to get it. Can you cut it down, bring it back, strap it to the top of our car? Yes, right away, sister. And you're out there dragging the tree across the lot at age 14. And by lot, I mean like 5 acres in the middle of the country. So that was a hard job. And you know what? The day went faster when the nuns were telling me to go get that tree. It was slower if you were sitting around on like a Thursday and it's raining and they're going, go out and, you know, find all the stumps that people didn't cut all the way down to the ground or didn't cut level. And here's the saw. Go saw those off so that nobody trips over them or that they grow back correctly 10 years from now. So that was harder work. I also worked at Kmart back in the day. Don't laugh at me. I saw that. People snickering in the back over there. I worked at Kmart. I worked in the appliance area at Kmart. It's where I learned a little bit about retail sales, because what Kmart would do at that time is they would tell us, all right, here's the all these TVs you have, and I'll never forget this, and you should know this when you go into any kind of appliance or television or washing machine or refrigerator store. Stephen, they would tell us, like, hey, this is the inventory we have in the back. And if people ask you what the best TV is, because they always do, you're going to tell them this one because it's the one we have the most of. And, you know, when you're 16, 17, I don't know which TV is the best TV, but it happened to be the one that we had in stock. That was the best TV. Had nothing to do with the price. It had to do with inventory.
Well, that, I have that problem with my wife. She always asks people at restaurants, like the waiters and waitresses, like, oh, what do you like? Like, what's the best thing here? And it drives me nuts because it's like, well, you guys have different taste buds. Like, you have a different palate. Like, why are you even asking her or him? Like, what does this even help? And then they go with whatever they want to do.
The thing I ask in a restaurant is I ask him, what do you eat on your break? Because it rattles him a little bit. And I always pay attention if they say... Because what they're trained to do, what servers are trained to do, and I was told to do this when I was a server, is you're going to suggest one or two items that are the high-priced items on the menu, where the biggest margins are. And so I'll always pay attention, like, are they steering me towards, like, the prime rib? Or are they steering me, are they going, you know what I do on my break? I get the enchiladas, and I put it in a bowl of rice, and I mix it together. It's not really on the menu, but if I were you, I'd get the enchiladas. They're really good. That's the server you can trust. The server who doesn't give you like that one item that, you know, raises their tip. And I'll pay for that. I don't mind that. But, you know, I feel like this show, the last couple of days, the first hour of the show, you said it to me yesterday at the end of hour one. You were like, that was a great hour. And then today I had the same feeling. I was like, man, we're rolling. Maybe it's college football season. I don't know what it is. But the energy feels good on the show right now. All right, we're going to play some Punch It Audio. Jim Etzel of Sport Oregon will be joining us. And we will talk about the NFL and Major League Baseball, NFL regular season, Major League Baseball playoffs coming up as well. Are Padres still in, Steven? They're still in.
Padres and the Tigers still in.
Padres
those my,
in.
Those are my squads, Padres, Tigers. Let's go.
I lost my Orioles. I had the Orioles.
You got to jump on the Tigers with me.
Okay, maybe I'll get on that bandwagon. All right, we'll talk about that. Dana Altman, Eric Musselman, Chauncey Billups. Who else? Well, you'll hear Punch It Audio now.
We interrupt this broadcast with a special announcement from the Bald-Faced Truth Headquarters.
Hey, we're all about truth, justice, and the American way here, okay? Which is why we've spanned the globe and pulled the top audio cuts of the day.
You're going to hear little snippets of sound.
Hey, it's time for Punch It Audio.
Presented by First Call Heating and Cooling.
Dana Altman, Oregon basketball coach, talking about the tradition of the Big Ten Conference. Ducks are in the Big Ten. Punch it.
Well, there's a lot of tradition in the Big Ten. Obviously, the Pac-12 had some tradition with UCLA, Arizona. We've had some good programs. We've had a good stretch. But the Big Ten with, you know, Indiana with great tradition, Michigan State, Michigan, Purdue, you know, there's a lot of tradition over here. And so we're excited about that. We're excited to be involved with that. Tom and I were just talking about the trips, you know, those five road trips in January, February, March, and we're not used to having weather problems on the West Coast.
Oh, we don't have weather programs.
So that may disrupt our travel a little bit more, but it's a big change for us, but one our fans are looking forward to, and our program is also.
I don't know from a Big Ten standpoint yet to how I should feel about Oregon basketball in the Big Ten. I think it'll be easier in some respects because, no Arizona, maybe no UCLA over a perennial time because UCLA's not great right now. You know, so maybe it is an easier conference, meaning UCLA's down, not out, but they're a little down. And yet, I find myself oddly hopeful that this change of scenery is going to infuse new enthusiasm with fans at Matthew Knight Arena. I'm also not going to lie. When I saw Gonzaga in the Pac-12, I thought, why couldn't that happen when Oregon was in the conference? I would have loved to see those schools play on a regular basis. And they often dodged each other for different reasons. Eric Musselman, Big Ten Media Day, talking about his staff. New coach at USC, went into the portal big time in the offseason. Here's Musselman.
And when you got there, I think the story is amazing that you and your assistant coaches basically rented a house together, and it was just portal central.
That's not a story. That's true.
Yes, yes. Portal Central, like, what, 20 hours a day? I mean, how much time did you give them to actually decompress?
They probably slept about 4.5 hours a night.
That seems like enough.
It was enough. That's what I felt like. Sometimes too much sleep.
Yeah.
But it was funny because we were at the USC hotel, and my wife called one day and said, hey, I rented you a place in Manhattan Beach for your whole staff. I said, really? For the whole staff? So there was like 7 of us in there, and every day we had depth charts all over every room.
A lot of depth charts. Putting together a fantasy league team over there. Musselman, great hire by USC.
But doesn't this kind of just show how crazy college sports are now? Like 20 hours a day in the offseason? Like you're studying other teams' depth charts just to fill out a team? It doesn't seem right.
It's bad. It's not what we all envision college athletics to be. Joel Klatt, he likes Washington to beat Michigan this week. I don't. I trust Michigan more. Here's Klatt, though.
I think Will Rogers, the Washington quarterback, is a pretty good player. If Jed Fish can protect him, I think that they'll be able to throw the football, which USC and Minnesota did in the second half against Michigan. Will Rogers, 10 touchdowns, no interceptions. I like Washington in this game, guys. I really do. The second half of each of the last two games for Michigan, the fact that they have no margin for error, the fact that Washington played a very good game but just wasn't clean at the right times against Rutgers, they can clean that up. I think Washington wins. I think that they win this 24-17.
That kind of game, I agree with Klatt and you, Stephen, as well, that it's that kind of game. But I just trust Michigan a little more at this point. Jed Fish has had some real weak moments. The end of the Apple Cup game, he probably should have run a different play. He didn't. Blamed it on execution. His team at Rutgers on Friday, last Friday, running out onto the field after a blocked field goal, get a penalty. Rutgers turns it into a touchdown. I mean, they're losing games in foolish ways these days. Have they learned anything? We'll find out. Bruce Feldman. He's a Heisman voter. If I had to fill out my Heisman ballot right now, I would have Travis Hunter second. I'd have Ashton Gentry at the top of the ballot, Boise State running back. What would Feldman do? He likes Travis Hunter.
If they gave it out right now, he would definitely get my vote, and I think he would win it. You know, the only guy who had ever played a high number of snaps like this at a pretty high level was Chris Gamble from Ohio State. You know, I remember doing a story back when I was at ESPN Magazine of a similar Travis Hunter-like numbers. The difference to me is Travis is doing it at an incredibly high level, and he's making, you know, game-changing plays, you know, late in the game in the second half, whether it's the diving pick last week where it looks like he comes away from like 8 yards off the ball.
Look, Travis Hunter's a great player. Colorado, in my mind, if Hunter's going to win this thing, Colorado's got to win 9 games in the regular season. They got to be 9-3. And I think that's a little outside their reach. In the last 30 years, you haven't had a Heisman Trophy winner come from a team that has had more than 3 losses.
Yeah, RG3 was one of the big ones that did that. But even with the way they played at UCF, like, what if they did they figure it out? If they play like they did against UCF, John, is 9 wins out of the question for Colorado? I don't know that it is. They may be, dare I say, competing for a Big 12 championship if they played like they did against the UCF and they figured it out.
I don't know if that is enough. Because I looked at UCF, remember going into that game, I pointed out UCF didn't have quality wins. All the teams they had wins over were bad teams. It was kind of a fakey Bob undefeated record at that point. And I think Colorado's offense was just too much for UCF. But, you know, I just go back to the idea that you've got to win games in order to do this, you know. Baylor that year you talk about was a 3-loss team. Right? So nobody's had 4. So that's the marker. You know, 9-3 or better, you're on that ballot and you got a shot. I also think the same applies kind of to Boise State's Ashton Gentry in a different way. Because Boise State's got a little bit of a conundrum. You know, they've got a loss to Oregon, but it was a really respectable loss where Oregon kicks a field goal at Autzen Stadium to beat them. And I think Boise State leaves that game looking pretty good. but they can't lose. They can't go to UNLV in October 25th, I think they play, or 26th that weekend. They play UNLV. They can't lose that game. And the other thing with Genty is I really do feel like the Portland State box score tells the story. They only let him carry the ball 11 times. They got him out of the game when it was out of hand, and they got him on the sideline. And I think Boise State is trying to matter in the playoff more than they're trying to win a Heisman. And so I think over the long haul, Travis Hunter in Colorado, I think they're actually trying to win a Heisman. And they're talking about the Heisman, and they're openly saying, and he's posing like the Heisman. I think Boise State's trying to get to the playoff. And so I kind of wonder if Genty will, this week, next week, any week where they're not playing UNLV for the rest of the season, will they kind of throttle him down? Here's Genty talking about, you know, whether or not he's good. How good? Is he the best player in the country?
Yes, sir. And, you know, I play on one of the best teams in the country also. But, you know, I full-heartedly feel like that. And, you know, I think I've proven it a little bit. But, you know, I'm not done yet. I still got a lot more to prove. And, you know, as the season goes on, I'll keep proving that I'm the best player in the nation.
He thinks he's the best player in the nation. But, Steven, do you get what I'm saying? Like, his coach, Danielson, at Boise State, 11 carries against Portland State. He could have had 9 or 10 more carries, would have had another 200 yards. You know, it would have been ridiculous. If he's there to just pile up numbers and chase a Heisman, you leave him in that game. And so I am kind of looking at Boise State in the next few weeks, right? Like, you know, I circled that UNLV game on the calendar, but there's two games before then for Boise State. They've got Utah State at home this week. They're favored by 27 points. I kind of think Genty might play a half in that game. And Boise State will be happy just to win the game. And I wonder how they will manage him for the rest of the season. Do you think that is a factor in winning the Heisman Trophy? Because I think it got Jaden Daniels in the conversation and helped him win it last year.
No, I think you're right on that one. Because that's the question is, what's more important to Ashton Genty? What's more important to Boise State? Is it Heisman Trophy, or is it to get to the first round of the playoffs? Just based off what you hear Spencer Danielson say, the head coach, like, it seems like it would be about the playoffs. And what you hear Ashton Genty talk about, like, he's all about the team as well. Like, it seems like the playoff would be more important to both of them. Yeah, he's going to have to put up monster numbers also. Being at Boise State, like, yes, they are not going to have the national attention. So he's going to have to put up, you know, 2,100 yards and, you know, 27 touchdowns.
He's on his way.
That's a good point. He's on his way, but he's going to have to put out just insane numbers. Like, I think there could be a cool down period here because you can't, that is Boise State's offense, is Ashton Genty. They can't have him wear down. So I think you're right on that. If they get up in Utah State and they get up by 28 in the first half, yeah, I think they got, you know, kind of slow it down a little bit, but I mean, he still might win the Heisman. He still might run for 200 yards in the first half, and then you're still getting those numbers. But I think you're right on that. I think it's going to be tough for him to get. I think he'll be in New York. I don't think he's going to win the Heisman, though.
But his lowest rushing total of the season came against Portland State, and that tells me a lot about what the motivation of Boise State is. He had 127 yards and 11 carries. He had 259 against Washington State on 26 carries. I think they're going to try to manage his load as they win games. And so this week against Utah State, I will not be surprised if he only carries 15, 16 times and they get him out of the game. Aiden Childs, quarterback Michigan State, talking about the atmosphere he'll encounter on Friday night at Autzen Stadium.
I come from the Pac-12. It's good football. It was good football in the Pac-12. And it's a loud environment, great environment to play in if you really want to play on a big stage. And it's a good team. You know, I don't know. I'm not going to compare it to any other team. I think they're themselves, and they continue to be themselves. But I think they're a good team, and we have to come out and compete just like we do every other week.
Is it a different environment than you've already seen at Maryland and Boston College?
Oh, for sure, yes.
In what way?
It's loud. It's a lot louder than the schools we played at. Bigger stadium, I think, than both the schools, or more people, I believe. But, fans are really just in tune with the game, and it's going to be a fun atmosphere.
Yeah, it's loud there. Jonathan Smith, Michigan State coach, says you got to slow down Dylan Gabriel if you want to quiet that crowd.
Well, if you're asking me, yeah, I think it does. In the quarterback, you make him uncomfortable. That's going to slow down any offense and get a count on these guys because a lot, you know, complete 8% of your balls. A lot of those things are going sideways, quick screen to the receiver, that type of thing. Like Angelo mentioned, we've got to do a great job on the perimeter of the defense and slow that thing down. Because if it turns into like they want to run the ball a ton, we like that matchup.
Jonathan Smith at Michigan State, 6 o'clock Friday night. Big, big football game at Autzen Stadium. First Big Ten game. I wrote a column today at johnconzano.com about Sophia Lanning and the design of the Oregon Ducks jerseys. I think it's a really smart thing that Oregon did in letting her help design the jerseys along with their three sons this week. I got a text message from Don Lanning, Dan's father, telling me that he cried when he read it. If you want to check that out, go to johnconzano.com. Coming up, Jim Etzel. He is the CEO of Sport Oregon. You've got WNBA to Portland. You've got an NCAA regional, then a Final Four in the women's NCAA tournament in Portland. You got a plot of land on the south waterfront earmarked for a baseball stadium. Blazers starting a season in which fans are going to be able to watch their games on TV. You know, Jim Etzel in Sport Oregon, it's lightning in a bottle right now. He'll join us coming up.
You've got the home of the truth. Back to the bald-faced truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
Well, Portland's been on a roll. I know Crash Davis told us to not mess with a streak. Don't talk about a streak. I feel like Jim Etzel of Sport Oregon, the CEO of Sport Oregon, I feel like he's throwing a no-hitter, and it's like the fifth inning, and I'm walking over to him, and I'm like, hey, you're throwing a great game. But I want to bring him on here because let's think about it. WNBA picks Portland. The NCAA this week announced that a regional in 2028 on the women's NCAA tournament coming back to Portland. It's a dress rehearsal for 2030 when the Final Four will be here. It's already on my calendar. Now you've got the Diamond Project getting a piece of land on the south waterfront. The Blazers are on over-the-air TV. I feel like this guy's kind of on a roll. Jim Etzel, CEO of Sport Oregon. Hey, you're throwing a great game.
I wish I could take credit for everything, but yeah, it's been a good couple weeks here for Portland in sports.
There have been some bad times, right? Like, there have been some times when, you know, maybe your phone's not ringing or people going, why can't we get good things, or, you know, bad things are happening or the WNBA passes over. But did you see this trend coming? Could you see some things lining up on the horizon?
Yeah, I mean, it's really about, I mean, it's what we've been working on since I stepped in the door, is just trying to change the mindset and believe that we can reach for something higher than what we've had in the past, and you know, it's collaboration, it's just alignment, it's a lot of things across a lot of sectors, not just the sports sector, but you know, across business, across the policy making sectors, and helping educate and understand, getting real data, all those things to get people to get behind efforts. Like, I remember saying, we got a bid for a women's Final Four. And no. And then all of a sudden, you know, the experience of the Ducks in 2020 there, went in the regional and hosting the regional, and all of a sudden everybody's like, or excuse me, that was 2019. Everybody's going, oh my God, we could do this. And I go, yeah, let's go. You know, and it's like, it just took more than me saying it. People started having to believe it. And, you know, that's what it's about. And then now it just seems like we have a lot of momentum. It seems like we're in conversations and panel discussions and almost every week about the power of sport and what it can do for the city and what it means to quality of life. And it's just not sports, it's arts. I mean, heck, we got the Live Nation, venue got approved last week. We're like the only top 25 market without a venue like that. So it just seems like everybody's like, all in on trying to get our livability back and and then we got to update what we have to keep it viable and competitive, and it's exciting.
Jim Edsel, Sport Oregon, with us. Getting the NCAA regional back in Portland, did you anticipate it kind of as the way I saw it is you got the Final Four, you just had a regional, you got the Final Four in 2030. I kind of viewed it as a chance for the NCAA to have another dress rehearsal in Portland before the big dance.
Absolutely. This was a two-year cycle of NCAA events for 2027 and 2028. We submitted bids for men's first and second round. We submitted a bid for a men's regional, and we submitted a bid for the women's regional. But, you know, we're hosting men's first and second round in 2026. We kind of felt the way historically things go with the NCAA that they're probably going to skip over Portland in 27. To your point, we really we're on a roll with women's basketball. We wanted a dress rehearsal and to lock one up before 2030. So we bid for all three of those things because at the end of the day, they're going to assign where they want. But we did write a letter that said we really, if we had our choice, we wanted the women's regional. And it rolled our way.
The, you know, Major League Baseball group, the Diamond Project, getting a contract and getting you know, a piece of property on the South Waterfront under control here. You know, I got a peek at Populous, who's starting to do some design work on the architecture front, and looks like it could be pretty cool. What needs to happen for Major League Baseball, or maybe even a team that's looking for a relocation? And what needs to happen, Jim, to sort of position Portland as a viable baseball market?
Well, credit to, you know, Craig Cheek and Mike Barrett and everybody, Jed Lowry, that, you know, especially Craig and Mike, for, you know, 8 years now, they've been beating the drum and you know, trying to keep this vision and dream alive. And they could have secured land 5 years ago. We'd still probably be sitting here waiting for baseball to shift into expansion mode and you know, put an expansion committee in motion to pick two new markets. And then so we'd still be waiting to get into a game. But now I think everybody feels like that's getting closer. You know, maybe it happens after these winter meetings. Maybe it's the next winter meetings after that. But they needed to have a site under control to be able to put Portland into the conversation. So I think that's the biggest thing, is now we are legitimately are ready, you know, and a viable market. And so we're in the mix. We can talk about it, get excited about it. Diamond Project's going to sharpen the messaging and the vision. And the site is a dynamite site, just lots of possibilities there. So it would have sucked if they would not have been able to find that and secure land, and that baseball rolled out expansion and we weren't able to be in that conversation. So just having a shot at it, we got our at bat, right?
Yeah, you got to get to the plate. This is kind of sensitive. I'm going to ask you about it anyway, but you know, over the years I've wondered about politics in the state, politics in the city. The way that City Hall is changing its leadership structure, commissioners with the votes, how does that affect, maybe, you know, help or hurt the idea of baseball? Do you get a sense of the political support that might be out there?
I think policy circles, leadership, you know, whether it's city, county, state, metro, everybody's started to coalesce and understand the power of sports, events, arts, and how important those are to have a vibrant community. I think, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, there's a lot going on around the city and that needed people's attention. We were in crisis mode and it was hard to get attention, but they were always open to the conversation. I think the last couple of years, they have shifted into, okay, what do we need to do? Because, you know, everybody's, you know, come together. There's alignment now. There's collaboration that wasn't there 3, 4 years ago, even 2 years ago, across the board on the public side and the private side. And they have recognized for some time now what baseball could do. So I think they've been, you know, they've been aligned with the Diamond Project. At the end of the day, the Diamond Project needed to acquire land from a private landowner, so the city really couldn't impact that. Where the city can impact that, leadership in the city is aligning on, you know, like, you know, creating a runway once that's secured, and aligning and infrastructure and stuff like that. And I think everybody can see in leadership how something like this could be a real catalyst in where the future of our city goes.
And finally, like that piece of land, I mean, you know, a lot of the other sites came with debates after. And I can tell you, like, every time I introduced Lloyd Center or Terminal 2 or Red Tail, you know, the audience was often divided on whether or not this was good or bad. This South Waterfront piece of property, I mean, save for Cirque du Soleil not having a place to put their tent up, you know, a couple times a year, you know, they could do it in the parking lot of the baseball field moving forward. But, you know, it kind of works and it solves a problem. And, you know, it's a piece of land that isn't being utilized. And, gosh, could you imagine the sight lines and all that stuff? So gets my juices going. We're talking to Jim Etzel, CEO of Sport Oregon, WNBA to Portland. You know, I know you probably saw that coming, but what does it say about the market that there were three ownership groups all trying to get that franchise?
I think that says a lot about the marketplace and what people on the outside see in Portland, Oregon. You know, sometimes our biggest problem and wall to, you know, or hurdle to achievement is us. We got to get Portlanders believing in Portland again. And visitor sentiment's way higher than resident sentiment. People come here, we win. If we get a site visit opportunity to bring an event in, we win. Almost, I mean, we're batting 700 over the last 3 years when we get people to come here, look at our city, and they commit to it. And, you know, I just wish we could get all our neighbors to feel the same way, you know. And but at the end of the day, you know, three groups over the last 15 to 18 months, you know, went deep with the WNBA. And then WNBA had a choice between two groups at this time. So, and that says a lot. I love that people believed in the marketplace, believed in the opportunity. That says a lot. And I think that should turn some heads.
Give me an idea, you know,
some attitudes too.
We've talked about names for the team. I had a bunch of friends reach out to me who've asked, what do I think? And, you know, I naturally go to something like the Portland Roses, which might be too close to the Thorns, or I go to, you know, maybe the idea of playing off Trailblazers and going, hey, how about the Pathfinders, the Portland Pathfinders? I don't know, or the Pioneers or the Rain. Do you have a favorite so far, or have you heard any name possibilities that you like?
I haven't heard one that resonates with me yet, you know, and I don't know. You know, it's like, it's funny. I've been in a lot of people, like, you know, just like this, conversations. What do you think of this? What is there one out there? And I haven't heard it yet. You know, I'm sure it's going to emerge, and hopefully it's one that, you know, everybody loves at first. But a lot of times with names, sometimes people, you know, it takes some time for it to grow on you, you know? So, I don't know. I wish I haven't given it. I've talked about it a lot, but I haven't given it like that deep thought of creative thought. You know, I've heard everything out there. I've heard Swifts. I've heard, you know, Swifts. He goes on and on. All the ones that all the writers wrote about afterwards. And I, you know, none of them like jump at me. I hope it's something dynamite, you know, that everybody gets excited about. It's got to happen fast, though. I mean,
yeah, I know.
About 30 days to figure it out.
I got Marcus Harvey at Portland Gear texting me. He's eager to know the name. You know, he wants to know, right? So
he should be in the incubator conversation of figuring out, throwing the ideas on the table.
Spring football. Any shot Portland could be a destination for a spring football franchise? You know, these leagues come and go, but, you know, we saw the USFL in Portland once upon a time. Is that out there? You know, I've thought about, you know, do they have a venue? I don't know if Providence Park is really all that football friendly, but you tell me. Spring football, is that anywhere on the radar?
You know, I'm so old that I remember being a ball boy at training camp for the Portland Storm and Thunder, you know, in the 70s. they've all come and gone. It to me, it's like arena football. I know there's football fans out there, but it's like, I just think Portland's bigger than that. And no disrespect, to those leagues, but until you see some staying power with them, and I know that sometimes you got to bet early to be in it for the long play, but I don't know. Is Portland going to get excited by that? You know, are you going to fill Providence Park?
No. The answer is no.
No. And it said, to me, it's not worth it. If they're going to play at Hillsborough Stadium and draw 4,000 or 5,000, great. That'd be a great, you know, venue. But I mean, there was something that supposedly was coming a year ago. We never heard from them, but you know, they had gone out and said they're going to play at Hillsborough and all this, and then the league never emerged. I think the ones you're referring to are the ones that, you know, are out there and about now. But you know, all the hype that comes with, you know, Dwayne Johnson buying this or whatever, The Rock, and it's still nothing sticking outside of the NFL.
All right. So anything I haven't talked to, I agree with you, because I think if you start putting too many tractor pulls in the market, and, you know, it starts to feel like you're a smaller city. And when you go after Major League Baseball or the WNBA, they go, no, you're not that big of a market. I think you got to hold yourself above it. I think the WNBA helps Portland in a number of ways, you know, just from, hey, you got picked as one of those franchises. The league said that's a city we need to be in. Major League Baseball, will they follow suit? We will see. But what else am I not talking about? Any surprises coming? What are you working on that maybe you can share with the audience?
We got a bunch of bids out there, a lot of stuff on what I, you know, U.S. Federation type stuff, whether it's been gymnastics or fencing or things like that. A lot of stuff isn't really spectator driven. It's more economic room night driven stuff. You know, the Rockstar Energy Open Tour, which had 33 Olympic skateboarders and all three medal winners. You know, we brought that in August. It's coming back. It's going to be bigger next year than it was this year. You know, that drew 5,000 on Friday and like 7,500 on Saturday and 10,000 on Sunday. And they want to have more capacity because they have more demand. There's people up in trees watching it. So, you know, we're just looking for things that resonate with our region. And it's just, you're always, you know, putting opportunities in the funnel and you try to match. First, we got to have a venue that they'd work in, and then, you know, then the dates have to work and it has to fit in the calendar for both sides. It's complicated. It's like a big jigsaw puzzle, but we got a great, you know, tourism team that's out there. They were in Anaheim last week, meeting with probably, I think they had 56 meetings in 3.5 days. It's like speed dating, and you just kind of assess. They also know who they want and what those, you know, targets have, opportunities that we think are fit, and then we just start to, you know, try to piece it together and see if we can generate the interest and get it across the line.
Jim Edsel, Sport Oregon. You know,
organized team sports, I think we talked about it.
I appreciate you, man. Appreciate you making time. You're on a roll. Keep throwing strikes.
Thanks, man. All right.
There he goes. CEO of Sport Oregon. Feels like Portland's got some real momentum. I agree with him on the spring football. I think it's, you know, it's a little gimmicky and it's minor league. You're not in the NFL, you're in the minors. So you're not getting an NFL team. That window passed when the Delta Dome was not voted on by taxpayers and the Seahawks went to Seattle. Portland would have had the Seahawks, would have had the Delta Dome. Judah Newby could have driven a short distance to see the 12s, his friends, and watch the Seahawks lose to the 49ers every year. And it wouldn't have been a big deal. And he would have been happy, though, to have his team closer. So keep that in mind when, you know, this Major League Baseball thing rears its head. I do think there's some political will out there. I think the temperature or the winds have changed at City Hall. I think they've got, you know, their hands on this South Waterfront. I did have a representative of the Arizona Diamondbacks reached out to me after the waterfront ballpark property was talked about. Diamondbacks are in an interesting situation in Phoenix. They've got a real issue with Maricopa County there, where they are fighting over the lease at Chase Field. And, you know, they're supposed to be there through 2027. They probably are not going to extend their lease there. Doesn't look like they're going to get a new ballpark. the Diamondbacks may be on the move. So the Diamondbacks have kind of looked at, will they go to Salt Lake City? Will they go to Portland? I actually think it would help Portland if the Diamondbacks did move, because all of a sudden you either get the Diamondbacks or the Diamondbacks go to Salt Lake City, and now you're sitting as the lone city in the West. There's also the matter of the A's in Vegas. Like, there's a real possibility that, you know, Vegas doesn't get it together. John Fisher trying to go to Vegas, he doesn't really have the investors. Like, there's, you heard Ed Graney on yesterday's show, the Las Vegas Review Journal. He's like, I don't know. Some days it feels like it's going to happen. Some days it feels like it's not going to happen. Supposed to go to Sacramento for 3 years, two, three years. Then what happens? Do they stay in Sacramento? Do they go somewhere else? Do they go back to Oakland eventually? Or do they go to a city like Portland, who's got its arms open? I there's a couple of relocation options that I still think are out there. But, you know, MLB has got to pick Portland. Leave it here.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
What needs to happen to make the Major League Baseball playoffs the best they can possibly be? Let's think like Major League Baseball is probably thinking right now. I'm going to put you, Stephen Vaughn, in the position of Major League Baseball Commissioner Rob Manfred. Down deep, Rob Manfred probably does have a dog in the fight. He's going to tell his children he all loves them equally. He's going to say to his TV partners, let's see how the chips fall. But honestly, as we look across baseball and see wonderful things happen.
Jackson Churio leads it off against Maton. Fly ball, right field. It is deep. It is gone! We are tied in the eighth inning on the second homer of the night from Jackson Churio.
There it is. Postseason picture right now. What's the best for the postseason? Who do you want in the ALCS? Who do you want in the NLCS? What's the best for baseball?
Well, me as Rob Manfred, it's definitely the Yankees with Aaron Judge. We don't, okay. We don't want the Royals in there.
Small market. Get them out of there.
Get them out of there.
Yankees.
And then on the other side, Cleveland and Detroit. I think we'd rather have Detroit over Cleveland. Okay. I think Detroit's had some success in the last 20 years. The Kenny Rogers days,
yep.
Stuff like that. And I think they're more of a better story than Cleveland. Like, I think they would provide more of a little story to go against the Yankees. And then on the NL side, it's obviously Dodgers and the Phillies. Like, you get Shohei Ohtani versus Bryce mm-hmm. Harper, that would be a grand slam. In the ALCS, NLCS, you got Judge, Harper, Shohei. That is the dream for Major League Baseball. And this is Shohei's first time ever in the playoffs. So, like, that goes along with the story as well. So I think that's what you want if you're Rob Manfred, which I am.
I was in Southern California for the Oregon-UCLA game, and I was aghast at how many Dodgers jerseys are walking around. Just everybody's wearing Dodgers gear. And we happened to be out at, what was that pier we were down at? We were down at Santa Monica. Near the pier, and they were having, there was some kind of food fair that was going on, and it was Thai food. It was a bunch of booths set up that were all different kinds of Thai food, right? And so naturally, the crowd walking around was largely Asian. I couldn't believe how many people were wearing Shohei Ohtani shirts and jerseys and Dodgers caps. LA has absolute Dodger fever right now. And you are telling me that the Dodgers and Phillies and the Yankees and Detroit are your final four. Am I to assume that the Yankees and Dodgers in the World Series is your dream World Series, Commissioner?
Yes.
If one of those teams, let's just suppose the Dodgers don't make it, would it be better if the New York Mets slipped through beat the Brewers, beat the Phillies, beat the Dodgers in an all-New York World Series? Or does a Phillies or Padres against the Yankees series do it for you?
I think it has to be the Yankees. I think
the Mets, you mean?
No.
I'm saying for the National League, if it can't be the Dodgers, what's the best matchup for the Yankees?
Right, so that's what I'm saying. So it's not the Mets for me. It's okay. Philadelphia. I don't think it matters. I think the Yankees are the only one that matters.
Okay. What if the Yankees can't go?
If the Yankees can't go, then it's okay for the Mets to slip in there.
All right. I just want to say to you, if the Yankees can't make it in the American League, Commissioner, follow me here. get all jumbled around.
I'm looking at
the bracket. I wish I could put the bracket in front of you. So if the Yankees can't get in the World Series and the Dodgers can't get in the World Series, is there a matchup that is going to deliver, or is baseball going to go? Is the narrative going to be baseball blew it?
Baseball blew it for sure, because then it would be, I think, best case scenario, Tigers versus Mets. Tigers versus Phillies.
Doesn't do it.
Doesn't do it for you. I think
Padres.
Yeah. You could go Royals, Phillies if you want to. I don't think that does it for you either. So, no. I think the Major League Baseball needs the Yankees to be in there from the AL. The AL is all crazy now with Baltimore losing and with Houston losing. Because even with Houston, like, they have a lot of people that hate them. So people will, you know, somewhat tune into that. They need the Yankees. They need the Yankees to get to the World Series really badly, or else I think it will be one of those, another year where we're all saying MLB blew it.
I think you're speaking for Rob Manfred here, and you're saying you got to have either Judge or Ohtani in there, one or the other, ideally both, or bust. As much as it would be cool to see the Royals and the Padres playing for the World Series, or the Mets against the Detroit Tigers, stars move the needle, and the rivalry of the Yankees and the Dodgers that I remember from my childhood being in the World Series could be reignited. Felt like they were in that World Series every other year, one of them. We shall see what happens with this World Series tournament. A little bit of drama as we watch this unfold. All right, the 5 at 5 is coming up. Then we're going to feed you right into Thursday Night Football. Jaden Robinson and the Jamba interview of the week will be airing tomorrow. Jaden had class from 3 to 5, so we have to respect that.
BFFT. From the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with the bald-faced truth.
I think it's Ohtani or bust, not just Aaron Judge or Ohtani. If I'm the commissioner of baseball, I think you need the biggest star in the game in the World Series and in the playoffs for as long as possible, and I'd even root for a 7-game World Series. Hell, I might root for there to be a possibility, not that I want this to happen, a possibility that Shohei Ohtani could get an inning on the mound. Like, you know, the Dodgers are in trouble. Game 4 and 5 and 6 all went extra innings. The arms are stressed out. Game 7 ahead. Could Ohtani pitch? Come on. Think of the ratings. Think of the ratings. That's what you have to think about. Got to be selfish if you're the commissioner of a sport. Yankees, Dodgers, Ohtani pitching to Aaron Judge in the 14th inning. Game 7.
Hey, you were the one that said Ohtani shouldn't be pitching in the playoffs.
No, he shouldn't.
But he should be. Think about that, though. Like you said,
no,
bottom
he shouldn't.
Of the ninth, Ohtani versus Judge.
He shouldn't be if I am me. But if I'm Rob Manfred, get him out there.
Mandatory.
Trot him out on the mound. Get my show pony on the mound.
Shoot him up. Shoot him up with the roids. Get him out there.
That's
what Bud Selig would have done.
And he looks like he can throw across the diamond. Can't, you know, what's the mound to home plate? But can you imagine a situation if, like, the Dodgers were in the World Series and, like, game 6 just stressed the bullpen out to no degree, and these games were all marathons, and here comes game 7, and somebody's starting their third game of the World Series, and you're saying all hands are on deck, because you always hear that. All hands are on deck, and we've seen starting pitchers come back in a World Series Game 7, and throw an inning in relief or throw two innings in relief. And it, game seven goes extra innings, and the Dodgers are out of arms. And everybody in the dugout is looking, side-eyeing over there at Shohei, looking at him like, can he go? You know, is he going to raise his hand, go down and talk to the manager and be like, hey, I can give you two innings. I can give you one inning. I want that kind of drama, but I don't think he should be pitching. He's got too much at stake. That said, I'm rooting for extra innings. All right, here we go. The five at five.
The five at five. Number one.
Does he have that dog in him? That's what we need to know. All right, John. Well, we know College Game Day is going to be in Berkeley on Saturday between Miami and Cal. Kind of a weird slate in college football. That's where it has to go. It's the first time they've ever been down in Berkeley. They just announced who the guest picker is going to be. Now, I'm not a big College Game Day guy, especially nowadays. I think it's a little not as good as it used to be. But Marshawn Lynch is announced as the guest picker. It makes a lot of sense. Obviously, he went to Cal as a legend there. He's great on TV. That might be must-see TV to watch Marshawn and see what he has to say on that for College Game Day on Saturday morning.
I hope that they let him go.
You got to get the dump button ready, but, you know, ready to go.
Imagine Pat McAfee hanging out with Marshawn all Friday night.
Like him and Nick Saban like that?
Yeah.
I mean, that has some potential to be kind of funny, I think. So I'm actually in on this.
The thing I like about Marshawn is that he's his own man. Like, he doesn't care. He'll speak his mind. I think he's educated on the subjects he's talking about. And so I find him rather refreshing because I am one of these people that has no tolerance for nonsense and, you know, small talk. And so when he's speaking, and one of the funniest videos I saw during the summer was the Marshawn Lynch football camp, and he was arguing with that mom who was complaining that he was cussing. And I was like, you're at the Marshawn Lynch football camp.
What did you expect? Yeah.
What did you think you were getting?
Marshawn Lynch has some of the funnier YouTube videos you can watch. Like, there's one of him with Conan O'Brien playing video games.
Yes.
I mean, it is hysterical. Like, you're right. Marshawn is just himself, and he's not ashamed of it. He loves, you know, loves the way he is, and I think that's it's really refreshing, like you said, just see a guy like that. So I'm actually excited to see who he picks this Saturday morning.
Anna will often get mad at me because in social settings, I tend to just say what I think. And I'm not and trying to be obtuse, so I'm not trying to be intentionally inflammatory. But if somebody asks me something, I generally will say what I think. And I don't care if they like me or not. I'm just kind of in that space time of my life where, like, I don't need to be liked. If you don't like what I'm saying, that's okay. I'm not going to say anything crazy or... But Anna's much more diplomatic and collegial that way. And she'll be like, man, I can't believe you said that. And I'd be like, well, they asked. They asked me. You know,
it's example 749, why people like Anna more than you, though.
Exactly. So, you know. 100%.
Number two.
Well, we knew it was going to happen, but it's official now. Caitlin Clark was named officially the WNBA Rookie of the Year. Now, John, she got 66 votes out of 67. One person did not vote for her to be Rookie of the Year. The other vote went to Chicago's Angel Reese. Fever players now have won the award in back-to-back seasons. Clark averaged just over 19 points, a WNBA best 8.5 assists per game. Clark was first in three-pointers in the season, second in minutes per game, and in free-throw percentage. She was also seventh in scoring. She set a ton of records. Obviously, the single-season WNBA record for rookies and everybody in assists, 337. She also had a single-game record, 19 assists in a game. She set a rookie season mark with 769 points and became the first rookie to record a triple-double. She had two of those. So overall, just a... I mean, she probably exceeded expectations, I would say, like the way she played and led her team to the playoffs.
Am I bad that I'm focusing more on Sabrina Ionescu and the run that her team might make? You know, like, you know what I mean? Does it make me a bad sports guy?
It probably makes you a good sports guy because you're actually watching what's happening right now.
I'm watching and I'm going, can we get someone from our region to win this thing? You know, like, I don't know. The semifinals are on. And I'm watching the Liberty, and I'm going, hey, they're up 2, what are they, up 2-0 in that series?
Up 2-0 over Las Vegas. Yeah, I mean, but hey, just think, WNBA, when it comes to Portland, get Sabrina here, get her against Caitlin Clark.
Yeah.
Must-watch games.
She is an unrestricted free agent in 2026. Keep that on your mind as Portland is putting together its roster for 2026.
Number three.
Kansas City Chiefs, they placed receiver Rashee Rice on injured reserve today, which means he will be out for at least four games. He sustained a knee injury in Sunday's game and Sunday's win over the Chargers after Patrick Mahomes collided with him after an interception thrown. Casey, they're not going to know more about the extent of the injury until next week, as Andy Reid said that Rashee Rice is waiting on the swelling to be reduced in his injured knee before undergoing further testing, but it does not sound good. I know there's initial fear of ACL, but we don't know that for sure. But the Chiefs, you know, they've been scraping by already. Now they're losing their best wide receiver.
Didn't look good, right? It would just kind of look like a weird one of those uncomfortable injuries. Bad week for the Rice family. Did you see his mom caught on ring camera?
I did. That made that made the honorable mention for 5 of 5.
Marsha Kearney was allegedly caught on a ring camera stealing a neighbor's package that contained a limited edition vinyl record. Porch pirates, beware. You shouldn't be doing that stuff. You don't know what's in the package. You don't know if I'm ordering quality stuff or junk. Why would you want it? And Marsha Kearney caught on ring taking a neighbor's package. She thought she was outside the scope of the camera, and it looks like she was kicking it down the way and then picking it up. And she's got on her back, Steven, she's got Rashee Rice's mom like on her back. What is she thinking?
I don't. She wasn't thinking, obviously. But yeah, the porch pirates.
Allegedly.
You can go away. You don't belong here on this earth.
Allegedly.
Yes.
I think all porch pirates should be allowed to be stun gunned. All right, moving on. We're on four now.
Yeah, we got to hurry to this.
Number four.
All right, this booted Rashee Rice's mom. QVC, you know the channel QVC, they have struck a deal with Pickleball on a multi-year deal that brings the home shopping network to Pickleball's governing body, and it'll begin showing Pickleball games, matches, I guess, in November of this year. Now, Pickleball has not broke into QVC's linear lineup, but that won't stop the channel from doing what it does best, sell things. The network is reportedly planning a Pickleball shopping collection featuring equipment for the sport, athletic appeal, apparel, accessories like water bottles, smartwatches, all that kind of stuff. But everyone's live sports, John. QVC getting involved as well. Should we see the Pac-10 on QVC?
So they're going to put Pickleball on the live streaming platform, and then they're going to sell stuff around it, right? They're going to mask the screen. It's not a bad idea. Everybody's getting in on the live sports action.
Number five.
I'm going to go with this real quick. The Raiders head coach Antonio Pierce, he got a show cause today from the NCAA. 8 years, so it looks like he will not be coaching in the college game anytime soon, as he is for penalties when he was at Arizona State as an assistant coach. Of course, you know, during the COVID-19 dead period, he was violating recruitment and things of that nature. So Antonio Pierce, 8 years show cause. Looks like if he gets fired from the Raiders, he'll just get a position coach job in the NFL.
Well, there you go. There's nothing like the NFL head coach retread factory to give us the next version of coaching, I guess.
I just love how coaches get show causes, then they go to the NFL and they're like, I'm getting paid more and I can still coach, so who cares?
There's no penalty, really.
Yeah, no, so what's it do? Nothing.
If you're not cheating, you're not trying, what's the message to kids? I don't know. All right, read me at johnconzano.com. Back tomorrow, Jaden Robinson, Jamba interview will air tomorrow right here on the BFT. Not here for a long time, just a good time. Enjoy the NFL game on this great Thursday night.